Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a public rulemaking hearing to consider public comment on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's campaign finance rules. The date is September 1, 2009. We're meeting in the Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting the rulemaking hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Bernie Buescher. And in accordance with a notice of rulemaking that was published in the Colorado Register on August 10, 2009, the original notice of rulemaking, I believe, was issued on July 31, 2009. Other introductions of the people at the table here with me. To my immediate left is Stephen Bowie, who is the manager of the campaign finance section in the Secretary of State's office. To my far left is Paris Nelson, a legal specialist in the campaign finance area for the Secretary of State's office. To my immediate right is Hillary Rudy, legal analyst with the Elections Division. And to my far right is Andrea Geiger, also a legal specialist with the Secretary of State's office. There is a sign-up sheet on the table by the door for anyone who wishes to testify. We have received, I think, a couple of written comments about the rulemaking for the proposed rules. The original rules that were published with the notice of rulemaking have been revised somewhat, and there is a revised set of proposed rules dated August 27, 2009. A copy is on the table by the door. That's the version that we will be working off of today. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. It's recorded. It's also broadcast over the internet. I anticipate what we'll do at the end of the hearing, after an opportunity for testimony has been given, I'll probably leave the rulemaking record open until the end of the week in order to provide additional opportunity for the public to provide written comments on the proposed rules. I might just mention a little bit about the background on the proposed rules. There is a proposed statement of basis and purpose on the table by the door that provides a little more detail about the purpose behind proposing each of the amendments. In general, there's several categories of reasons, I guess. One is to implement new legislation. That would include House Bill 09-1357, which transfers to the Secretary of State's office from the County Clerk and Recorder's office the responsibilities for being the filing officer in the case of most local filings of campaign finance reports. So there are some changes in the rules to implement that statutory change. There is also a rule change relating to House Bill 1353, because that bill codified into statute Rule 1.6, which dealt with the definition of an issue. There are some proposed rules that deal with various questions that have come up for the Secretary of State's office. And there's also some proposed rules that deal with the development of the new campaign finance system, the TRACER system, which we expect to roll out the 1st of January of next year. So there's some changes along those lines as well. Like I say, for more detail, there is an explanation in the proposed statement of basis and purpose. I think that's it by way of preliminaries. I want to open it up for public comment. I have several people signed up to testify, so I'll start with Chantel Taylor. Taylor, if you'd come forward, and for anyone who wishes to testify, please do identify yourself and who you represent. Hi.
Thank you. Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Chantel Taylor. I'm the director of Colorado Ethics Watch, And thank you for this opportunity to address the rules. We did submit, on behalf of Ethics Watch, some written comments. I'm not going to address all our points in the written comments. I'd like to just focus in my testimony on the change to Rule 6.1 specifically. This rule is characterized as a clarification to the existing Rule 6.1, and we would submit that no clarification is actually necessary on the rule, and so we actually oppose this rule change for the following reasons. First of all, we would submit that this limits the Secretary of State's ability to enforce campaign finance laws, and therefore the rule itself is arguably, or the rule change is arguably unconstitutional. Secondly, we oppose it because it removes at least the potential of, although the rule hasn't historically been proactively used, it removes at least the potential of a non-adversarial process by which to resolve campaign finance violations or possible violations. And that's a real critical process that if with this rule change, we potentially lose it. So let me address each of those points in turn. First of all, this and limiting the ability of campaign finance enforcement. As it's set up right now with this rule, there are two ways that campaign finance violations can be vetted or alleged violations. One is by the Secretary of State through Rule 6.1 to be able to take a look at the violation and give an opportunity for the alleged violator to be notified of the possible violation and then explain why it's not a violation. In the purpose that's been handed out, the stated purpose for the rule change, you know, this process is characterized as an investigation, but I would submit to you it's not actually that involved. Really, it's a non-adversarial way for a potential violation to be cured without litigation, without a formal complaint. And without that process, we're relying purely on litigation. And I would submit that that's not not beneficial for the public or even efficient for this office. This two-track system of enforcement by a private citizen through a formal complaint and enforcement by the Secretary of State through this inquiry, this notice and opportunity to cure, this two-track system was recognized by the Court of Appeals in a recent decision, the Patterson Recall Committee versus William Patterson. It's 209 P3rd 1210, and it's April 2009 decision. And the Court of Appeals looks both at the rule and the constitutional mandate, Article 28, Section 9, which gives the Secretary of State the enforcement power over campaign finance laws and the Fair Campaign Practices Act and terms in Article 28. It specifically addresses Rule 6.1, saying that there are two ways of enforcing these laws. One is by a private citizen, a private action. That's outlined in Section 9.2a of Article 28 of the Constitution. Any person who believes a violation has occurred can submit a complaint. That's definitely one way, and that's a very important process. Ethics Watch has invoked that process before, and you know, we're not suggesting that that be diminished in any way, but we are with the Court of Appeals in that there is a second track, and the second track is that the enforcing agency can also initiate a process, this notice and opportunity for the alleged violator to cure. So historically, Secretaries of State, and it appears that Secretary Buschert is taking the same position, have said, no, campaign finance laws are enforced by private enforcement actions. That's an unfortunate and counterproductive position because there is a way that we can take this out of politically charged litigation, oftentimes politically charged litigation, and into a preliminary, pre-formal complaint process. And that's contemplated by the Constitution and the rules. So to the extent that the rule would limit it to situations only when the secretary or staff discovers in the ordinary course of their business a violation would significantly narrow that, eliminating the ability for a citizen who may not have the means or, you know, the wherewithal or the courage to file a formal complaint, or maybe doesn't even have the amount of information they need to file a complaint, to notify the Secretary of State there's a possible violation. The Secretary of State's office can then from there through 6.1 notify the alleged violator, get an explanation. If no explanation is provided, then proceed with the complaint process. Anything less than that narrows the constitutional mandate, and in that respect, we would argue that the rule is unconstitutional. So related to that is our second point, and it's it kind of underscores the first, is that, you know, this non-adversarial process was actually the purpose behind the rule when it was initially adopted. If you look at the 1999 stated purpose for this rule, it actually talks about how an alternative to the adversarial process, to a formal, you know, an alternative to a formal complaint is necessary, because there are those inadvertent violations, there are those alleged or sometimes politically charged, it's one candidate against another, or it's a 527 against another political group, alleged complaints that, you know, it takes getting into the formal complaint process before you find out, oh, actually, this was inadvertent. This rule was a way to avoid those kinds of, uber litigious responses whenever anybody files a couple days late or, you know, a violation big or small. And I think what's really important to note in that language from the stated justification in 1999 when this rule was passed is that they recognized that without the rule, the office would, quote, be forced to ignore the violations that are brought to them and allow them to continue, these violations, allow them to continue and perhaps grow larger until some later day when a complaint might be filed. That's exactly what this rule and the premise behind it would do. If the Secretary of State's office gets notice that there's a potential violation, simply because they didn't discover it on their own in the ordinary course of their business, they have to ignore it and wait until a complaint is filed, and the violation just continues to grow. And we would submit that that's really counterproductive to the stated purpose and not consistent with the constitutional mandate of Article 28. So we would ask the Secretary to revisit this rule, not implement a rule change, and in fact go back to the original stated purpose of the rule and start using it as a non-adversarial process by which potential violations can be cured. We give some more examples in our written testimony that we've submitted, but ultimately, this comes down to the fact that it's certainly not a necessary rule change. This rule change is not necessary to enforce campaign finance laws. And in fact, we think it really eviscerates some of the stated purposes of the campaign finance rules. So I would defer then to our written comments.
Thank you,
Ms. Unless there are any questions.
I would like to ask a couple of questions. And you know, and actually, I don't want to belabor the point because we've had plenty of discussions about the purpose of 6.1 and so forth. But I would like to go back to the beginning in a way. I think you correctly looked at the authority of the Secretary of State in Section 9. And obviously, Amendment 27, which enacted this, did provide for a private right of action, as you described, and a citizen complaint process. What is the authority for Rule 6.1? What is the authority of the Secretary of State to investigate violations? I don't actually see it there. I see Section 9, for example, says the Secretary of State shall prepare forms and promulgate rules and maintain a filing system and so forth. It may be there. It among the list of things is to refer complaints to an ALJ and so forth. But What authority does the Secretary of State have to investigate complaints?
I would say two things to that. One, it's certainly not precluded. It's certainly not allowed, right? It's not shut out of possibility in Article 28. Section 9 specifically says it's the Secretary's duty to enforce campaign finance laws, and then it lists, you know, all the different ways that enforcement can happen.
I'm sorry, where are you referring?
Well, just Section 9, duties of the Secretary of State enforcement. You know, the title is enforcement, and then it outlines ways to enforce.
And that's kind of, I'm sorry for interrupting. I was just trying to find where in that list the Secretary of State would investigate.
Well, again, we don't think it's an investigation. We think it's notice and an opportunity to cure. I mean, it actually doesn't say subpoena power or use the word investigation. We don't think it's that full-blown. But the Secretary of State would have the ability to compel information through this rule in a way that a private citizen would not. So, like, for example, with the limited liability company rule, that candidate committees are required to keep affirmation of how the limited liability contribution is allocated among its members. There's no responsibility to report that to anybody. I, as a private citizen, could call and ask a candidate committee to provide me that information, but there's no obligation to give that to me. But if we have some reason to believe that they're not complying with that, the Secretary of State, through this rule, could say there's a possible violation. You know, we have reason to believe there's a violation of this LLC rule. You're on notice. Please, you know, provide information to support a conclusion that no violation has occurred. And then they can send in their affirmations. The problem with the private complaint process is that there's no reciprocal gain for a private citizen. There is no gain, but there's a lot to lose. You can be sanctioned for a frivolous complaint, and you know your personal resources go on the line when you bring a complaint, but there's no real benefit other than the public good. And that's why our organization, its mission is, you know, to represent the public in that. So we don't worry about the fact that we don't get monetary gain out of it. You know, that's our mission. But going back to the authority of the Secretary of State, I think it's also implicit in Section 2A, where they talk about the decision may be in the middle. You know, decisions of an ALJ can be enforced by the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State can file enforcement actions. That's in when they're talking about an ALJ decision. The Secretary of State does have the ability to enforce those if a private citizen doesn't bring the action.
Right, okay.
So I think the enforcement is, you know, implicit in Section 9. I think it's consistent with the stated purpose of Article 28. I think it has been interpreted by the Colorado Court of Appeals exactly as we're proposing here, that there is this authority to notify and file a complaint if necessary for the Secretary of State to do that. So I think there's ample authority, and I think going the other way, you know, to narrow it in any way, to narrow the enforcement ability, is contrary to the Constitution, because we don't have nothing in Article 28 suggests that the Secretary of State's authority is narrowed to only those instances that come up on their own personal discovery in the ordinary course of business. I mean, there's just simply no support for that in Article 28.
I think the proposed amendment reflects the Secretary of State's historical interpretation of 6.1, but I think I hear you saying, I mean, you disagree with that. And I think I also heard you say at the beginning that you think this amendment is unconstitutional. Could you elaborate on that as well? In other words, it sounds like you're saying Rule 6.1 is required by the Constitution, and it can't be narrowed the way the proposed amendment would narrow the rule.
Yeah, I think that to the extent it limits the Secretary of State's authority to only those instances that it itself discovers, as opposed to the office or the Secretary of State discovers, as opposed to if a private citizen calls in and notifies the Secretary of State of a possible violation. I think the Secretary of State turning a blind eye to that possible violation is unconstitutional, because it is tasked with enforcement. And in that scenario, it would be sitting, the Secretary of State's office would be sitting on its hands and not enforcing. So, you know, even to the extent that Section 10 authorizes the Secretary of State to impose penalties, I think that's consistent with the argument made by the Court of Appeals and that we're making here, that, you know, there is a enforcement ability. The Secretary of State can impose penalties. It's no different than if a violation is discovered by the Secretary of State and by one of your staff. And then, you know, a notice goes out and you've missed your filing and you have so many days to cure or you're penalized. Consistent with the discretion to waive penalties for a show of good cause, which the Secretary of State routinely does, this position that we're taking, you know, and that the Court of Appeals has interpreted Article 28 to say, you know, is consistent with that same authority, the same authority to penalize, grant waivers. We're not asking anything beyond that, and this rule doesn't do anything beyond that. So I think all that 6.1 did when it was initially adopted was take that implicit authority and make it, give it a process, give it a give due process too for the public to know, oh, I'll have the opportunity to respond and give information to support a conclusion that no violation has occurred. It gives a process by which no formal complaint is necessary and violations can be cured. To the extent that that enforcement authority is narrowed in any way, that's why we would argue that it's unconstitutional.
Okay. Well, and maybe one last thing, and again, I'm not trying to belabor this.
If anything, we're belaboring it. I've been arguing this since I started this job 3 years ago.
We've had a lot of discussions over the years with others as well. But the other major issue that I think that frequently comes into these discussions is basically the question of whether that interpretation, I think the interpretation that you're putting forward, opens up the possibility of arbitrary and capricious enforcement by the Secretary of State. In other words, what I think I hear you saying is that anyone should be able to notify the Secretary of State of alleged violations. The Secretary of State, under Rule 6.1, should be able to, and I'm not sure investigate is the right word, but at least inquire of the alleged violator to what extent there's a violation, and then choose, I think under 6.2, then the Secretary of State, if the Secretary of State believes there's a violation, then would file a complaint after that inquiry.
It may. It's not required, correct. 6.1 says it shall notify and give an opportunity for the alleged violator to respond. That's mandatory under the rule.
So the question is, in exercising that discretion that the Secretary of State may go forward with a complaint, and the Secretary of State is a partisan elected officer, isn't there a potential that people will feel that the Secretary of State will exercise that discretion in a partisan way?
Well, with all due respect, I think that's kind of a red herring, only because the Secretary of State makes discretionary decisions all the time with the knowledge that it's a partisan position. So the whole, every election run, that's why there's actually, you know, extensive debate over whether the Secretary of State's position itself should be a nonpartisan election and an appointed position, not an elected position. You know, there's an abundance of debate over that. I think the Secretary of State's office makes decisions every day that could be, a finger could be pointed and say, that waiver you gave that lobbyist was favoritism. That was arbitrary because you're giving more waivers to Democrats than Republicans. Or you're harsher on Republicans when it comes to waivers for campaign finance violations, but you bring down the hammer on Democrats. I mean, I think that argument stands no matter what decision the Secretary of State makes. It's certainly not a basis to avoid the obligations under Article 28. I mean, as I see it, and apparently as the Court of Appeals sees it, this is a positive tool that can be used to actually eliminate extensive, highly partisan charged litigation. I mean, there are, our organization gets charged all the time publicly with being partisan. When we have what we think is not a good faith basis, enough information to file a complaint, then it's not that nothing should be done. This is where the Secretary of State can come in a non-politically charged, non-adversarial way, say, okay, you know, there's been this allegation. Now you have the opportunity to explain, you know, whether there is a violation. And then that information could come out. I mean, there's a lot of situations like with the LLC rule where the holder of the information is the alleged violator. And there's no real authority to get that out. I mean, we've been in cases before where we're criticized for not simply getting the information from the respondent before filing a complaint. But there's no obligation for the respondent to provide that information. And quite frankly, in most of these political cases, it's incredibly contentious and it's untenable to suggest that there would be this, you know, give and take and the information would just flow freely. So I think the partisan nature of it, if the Secretary of State doesn't have that finger pointing, then what we're going to have is a campaign finance enforcement system that is strictly focused on the goodwill of private citizens, or maybe ill will, to come forward and risk sanctions for no reciprocal benefit to find out whether violations have occurred. And I really think it would be in the Secretary of State's, within their sort of mission and for the public good of Colorado to take it out of the highly litigious, politically charged adversarial system and resolve some of these things. That was the stated purpose of the rule in the first place, was to sort of take away from these complaints against inadvertent violators, or, you know, maybe it's a minimal violation that can be quickly resolved. And instead, you know, you see it every election cycle. There's complaints filed back and forth, and as quickly as a complaint is filed, you know, there's allegations that it's frivolous, and then there's sanctions, and then, you know, it's so. I think it's in the best interest of Coloradans to have an alternative to that. And it's right here. It's in the rule. I don't really see the downside other than, as we've discussed this in the past, it keeps coming back to, but doesn't that compromise the position of the Secretary of State as a partisan role? Doesn't it put them, you know, the Secretary of State's office under scrutiny for arbitrarily and capriciously targeting? But that seems to be the only downside, really. And if that's the only downside, I would say you're faced with that anyway. So I think it'd be worth, and the benefit to the public would be greater than any potential risk of finger-pointing in response.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dingell.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mike Williams. Weisman, did I say Williams? I'm sorry. Welcome.
Thank you. Mike Weisman with the Colorado Democratic Party. I have what I think is a fairly small comment based on the proposed changes to 2.1. And it's really partly about 2.1 as we're discussing it today, and partly just to sort of get a comment on the record for future potential rulemakings that may go in a similar direction. Specifically, the ability of the Office of the Secretary to substitute for a paper traditionally mailed communication, instead to use an electronic form of communication. Generally speaking, I think that kind of substitution, insofar as it saves state time, resources, paper, is entirely appropriate. I think that's the direction we're all kind of going in the world. And I certainly think any registered agent for any committee, be it a party committee or any other kind of committee under the jurisdiction of the office, does have responsibilities to be mindful of communication to and from the office. That said, I think we probably all see this in some way in our own personal daily lives. I think there can be more vagaries, more small mishaps in the flow of electronic communications than there are with the Postal Service, rain and hail and snow and dark of night and all that stuff about our friends who deliver the letters. So as in 2.1 we contemplate the use of an email communication, and as we might do something similar in the future for any manner of official correspondence. I just wanted to suggest that there might be a safeguard built in. To the way I would think about it is to sort of separate, true negligence or sort of missing an important communication on the part of the registered agent from what I might term a false positive due to some technical defect, an email glitch, or something similar. And I can see more things like this coming forward with Tracer and increasing use of electronic means. So I just wanted to suggest that in the case of 2.1 and in such future cases as we may use an electronic communication, that the mechanism used by the Office of the SOS to send out the notice, whatever it may be, come with some kind of return receipt requested mechanism. I think most email systems have some ability to do this, as simple as Microsoft Outlook that any of us run on our PC, and as complex as larger bulk type of email systems like the office might use. And generally speaking, that if a recipient of an electronic notification or communication from the office has not basically hit the button affirmatively acknowledging receipt of that communication within a certain number of days, 5, 7, 10, whatever, that it be the duty of the Office of the SOS to follow up with a safeguard, a written form of communication. The number of days allowed might need to vary, because I think in every case where there's a communication, there may be some penalty or some consequence which follows from that by a varying number of days. So I'll just make up the example of 5 days here might be appropriate, but I think going forward, as this sort of substitution of electronic for paper is made in other contexts, we might just want to be mindful of the number of days that is allowed between electronic and paper communication if necessary, so that we don't set, say, 15 days if there's a consequence within a 10-day window, just so that the agent gets the required notification and information and can be mindful of subsequent duties that he or she has to the office in adhering to constitutional, statutory, and rulemaking dictates by the office. So, I could propose example language or just leave that to the group.
I actually would like to see some sample language.
This is pretty quick off of the top of my head, but this might follow at the end of the proposed rule, or it might go between what look like sentences 1 and 2 right now.
And this is 2.1.
2.1, yes. Yeah. Any email of acknowledgement shall direct the registered agent to respond to the email confirming its receipt and shall be followed with an acknowledgement by postal mail, maybe that's how we phrase it, if the registered agent has not responded within 5 days or 7 or 10 or whatever the number of days is. I mean, I think this is a small issue. I think the number of instances in which it might come up is relatively low, but I would like to see, as this rulemaking contemplates moving away from paper communications and toward electronic ones, I would like to see a precedent established of that safeguard so that the registered agent for any type of committee is receiving everything that he or she needs to be. And ultimately, I think it may reduce headache for the office later. It's a small extra step to send that paper communication. After all, if the return receipt is not received, I appreciate that that's what the office is trying to get away from in this rule. But imagine a case where an email gets tracked by a spam filter, somebody fails to get something they need, 20, 30 days go by, we get into some he said, she said that ultimately benefits nobody and becomes more costly in terms of time and resources. So that's my thinking on this rule and future such rulemakings.
Would you mind, I like the language, would you mind making one more run at it again so we can get that wording down?
Oh, to read it, sure. And I apologize, I didn't have a chance to send this in print beforehand. Suggestion was, any email of acknowledgement shall direct the registered agent to respond to the email confirming its receipt and shall be followed by an acknowledgement by regular mail if the registered agent has not responded to the email acknowledgement within 5 days.
And ask you a question about email. I think you're pretty tech savvy. I'm not. But I think if I send an email that's return receipt requested, I think the receiver can, their settings can decline to send a receipt. Is that right?
I think in practice there would be some variation depending on the email program being utilized by the receiver. One, the email program that I use, if somebody has sent such a message, pops up a box as soon as I view the message, and it says the sender has requested a receipt, and you have a couple of buttons, send a receipt or decline. It is possible that somebody could receive a message requesting a return receipt, and for whatever reason they could decline to send that receipt, which would trigger the requirement, if the change I'm suggesting is adopted, that in fact the office send a paper communication by traditional mail. My suggestion would simply be in routine communication and perhaps on web pages that are relevant to agents, the office just stress the fact that it will use return receipt type of email communication to bring the need to just hit the yes, send the receipt button to the forefront of any agent's mind who's receiving the communication.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Weissman? Thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Any other comments? If not, then I will go ahead and leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on Friday, 5 o'clock on Friday. And so I would encourage and welcome further written comments. They should be preferably emailed to Andrea Geiger, I think. Is that correct? Andrea, A-N-D-R-E-A, dot Geiger, G-Y-G-E-R, at SOS dot state dot CO dot U-S, or delivered to the Secretary of State's office. One way or another, we'll get it in the right hands. So thank you all for your testimony and your contributions. I do appreciate it. We'll conclude the hearing. The time is 2:38 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you.